I need all the help I can get. Before we get started, I want to just talk a minute about, this last week was a week of rest for a lot of people because it was spring vacation, spring break and all that. And but it was a real busy week for us. And I guess I want to talk about a few things that kind of are on my mind. Of course, with the loss of people that we know and love, it's been pretty hard. Of course, we've got Guy Baker, which was just 10 days ago. And then we've got LaDonna Fultz. Many of you didn't know Bernie and LaDonna, but we've known them for 20 years, and they were in our class in Dawsonville, and they were neighbors. And she's been in a nursing home for the last year after a stroke, and then it just, she just got to the point where she couldn't swallow anymore. And of course, it was just a time then until she passed. And she passed on Monday morning, right after Easter, of course, on Sunday. So this past week has been kind of a blur. We were at the funeral home, and we had the service yesterday. And I want to thank all of you who came on Friday night and also Saturday for the service. They had a pretty good crowd. It was nice. Some people from the old neighborhood, some people from, they were Johnson Ferry members for many years. Some people from Johnson Ferry, a fairly large number from Redeemer. So really, really glad that that happened. Bernie will be trying to come back now. I guess they're both 90 years old. So he's going to, have a little, he's going to have somebody help him get here, I guess. But we'll see how that works. He's real excited to come back and join us in the class. Then the other thing, I guess, which is kind of the biggest thing on my mind, it's one thing for somebody who's lived 90 years in the circle of life, but it's another thing when teenagers are killed in a car wreck. And I sent a note out, and most of you have probably seen it in the news, but last week also, four teenagers were involved in a very bad car accident in Florida. Three of them died at the scene. The last one is, she's out of intensive care, I believe. I'm not sure about that, but she's beginning to respond. She had brain injury. She had a spinal cord injury, spinal break, broken back, and some burns, but they've begun to reduce her medicine, and she's able to wiggle her hands and squeeze a wrist and wiggle her toes. So hopefully her spinal cord is intact, and we just pray for her. And I guess the reason it's so serious for us is our granddaughter goes to Horizon Christian. She doesn't now, but she went for 11 years. And these were all friends of hers, people that she went on vacation with. They went on vacation with them and stayed at her house. And these three girls she was on the volleyball team with. So kind of a tragedy. And they were in Hawaii last week. So they got back at 7 this morning. So I would covet your prayers, not just for these families, because I can't imagine, the grief and loss for one family. The brother who was driving and the sister is the one who's in intensive care. And then the other two were friends that were in the back seat, and they both, passed away.
Yeah.
Yes.
One of the girls that passed away was an only child, and her mother is a friend of my friend, and an only child,
Yeah.
and the mother is divorced, so it was just her and the daughter.
Yeah.
That's gonna be
That's going to be
tough
that's
for.
Lynn, right? You're talking about Lynn. Yeah. That's Jalen, which is one of the girls. And then, of course, the other one, Charlotte has also lived in the neighborhood of where our daughter lives. So it's going to be a tragic situation. I would just, keep in prayer these families. I don't know how they get through it, but also keep in prayer all their friends. Most of us probably remember, I certainly remember, if you were in high school or grade school, and it's one thing when a grandparent passes away or an aunt or uncle. But when one of your friends, your same age as you, that you spent all time in school, dies for whatever reason, you remember that, and it stays with you forever. And I know all these kids that have friends that are now gone. This is kind of a mark in their life that they'll never forget. And I just pray that they can get through all the all the grief and process and kind of move on. So I don't know how you pick up from that. I know people do, but it's a it's an extremely gut-wrenching thing. And I just pray for them, and I would ask you to do the same. So that's been kind of on our mind. We'll see our daughter probably today or tomorrow. They're gonna probably go home and sleep. They've been on a plane from Hawaii and got in at 7 this morning. But once our granddaughter gets up and has to face the situation here, and the mothers and fathers, the other friends, and it's gonna be grieving all over again. So just pray for that. I don't know what else to say. That's really all we can do, I guess, at this point. I want to give you a little idea of where we're going to be schedule-wise. We're going to get to Zechariah 10 and hopefully in the first part of 11. These chapters are not real long, but they're kind of important, and so I don't want to rush through them. But what this kind of times out is there's 14 chapters in Zechariah, so we're getting close to the end. And what I'm thinking right now is when we finish on May 10th, Zechariah. I feel kind of led to do a series, and I don't know how many time, I don't know how many weeks it will be. Many of you probably remember in the old days we used to study something called What Baptists Believe. And there's little red books, little gold books. There's all kinds of little books that they publish. Most of them are out of print today, although you can still find them. We went on the internet to find them. But it's really important because as we especially a church like Redeemer, as we grow and so many people come in from other faiths, faith traditions, it's kind of important that we get straight on what it is we believe and why we think that's a distinctive belief. Not that it's the perfect belief of any kind. No, nobody's perfect. No denomination's perfect either. But it's important that we all understand where we come from because this church has a very well-known theology on what we believe and how we believe and what we do. And it's just important that we all understand what page we're on and recognize that. So that's kind of my plan right now. And then after that, we're going to be gone for 2 weeks in Florida. So I'll have to figure that out. But if I don't do Baptist belief the first, if I don't get it finished, then we'll pick it up when I get back. So we'll do it that way. So let me do a. I'm just going to do a fast update here because I don't want to take all the time for this. But the Middle East is still a cauldron of problems. I don't know whether we've got a ceasefire or whether we don't. I think rockets are still flying. So, maybe it's there, maybe it isn't. Some ships have gotten through the Strait of Hormuz, others haven't. But in any way you look at it, it's still a flashpoint. And some of the demands of Iran are absolutely untenable. They're not going to do it. I mean, it'd be almost like saying the U.S. controls everything in the Atlantic Ocean. You can't move a ship without the U.S. permission. Well, the Strait of Hormuz is international water, so that's not going to ever fly, that they're going to have a gateway and a passageway. So I don't know what's going to happen there, but I know one of our ships has gone through to kind of sweep for mines and make sure there's nothing in the way. And again, that'll happen. The world is posturing right now. Turkey has said if the war is not over, they may join Iran. None of that surprises any of us that are prophecy people because we understand Turkey is in that last alliance that comes against Israel, and they've been moving that way for years. Government shutdown, it's kind of off the news right now, but it's still going on. And we still, I think TSA is being paid, but the Coast Guard and Homeland Security are not. So there's still issues with that, and it's got to get solved. A lot of other things. Anti-Semitism rate is growing in the U.S. That's a really sad commentary. And then all other things are happening. The Pacific Rim is volcanic activities picking up out there. A lot of things that are part of the end time scenario are beginning to make themselves visible, and we'll talk about them as they get to be more pervasive. But just understand that things are happening. God is in control. We may be out of, we may feel out of control. We may feel like the U.S. is out of control. The world is out of control. But as I said so many times, actually the world is not falling apart. It's actually falling in place. It's falling in the place that God has aligned for what it's going to be like later. And so just be encouraged by that, and don't be discouraged by what's going on. I mean, certainly pray, but don't fret, because there's nothing to fret about. God's got this. Zechariah, it's been a few weeks since we've been in there. Since we let me get this over here and get rid of this so I can see. Back to the timeline. Zechariah was written after Israel came back from Babylon. Not all of Israel, but part of Israel. And Zechariah was dealing with the problems of rebuilding the temple. And the first part of Zechariah is a bunch of visions. And it finishes up with two very interesting sections on the future, both the close-in future, what you would call the first coming of the Lord, excuse me, and then it focuses on the second coming of the Lord. All of them pretty high level, but all of them important. And Zechariah is quoted several times in the New Testament. So you know that the writers of the New Testament understood the prophecies and understood the fulfillment of them. So we also see that. This is in the same time of Ezekiel and Daniel, a little later than both of those. And certainly the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, where if you want to go read the history of the rebuilding of the temple, you can go to those two books and you read kind of the narrative history of that. So we will get to Zechariah, excuse me, we'll get to Ezekiel, but not right away. I do want to do these other two sessions, and then we'll decide. I may want to do a New Testament book before we come back to Ezekiel. Ezekiel is a little longer, it's a little harder. Prophetic book. It's an interesting book for sure. But I do want to do it, and we'll do it before we get finished with all of this discussion. So the outline of Zechariah, just to show you where we are, the eight visions, the story about restoring the land of Israel, and then we come to this section we're in now, which is 9 through 14. And these are the prophecies of the coming Messiah. The first part is Messiah's first coming in 9 through 11, and we'll deal with most of the that today. We'll get through actually verse 8 or 9 today in chapter 11, hopefully. And then we'll pick up there and we'll get to Messiah's second coming. So understand this is a high-level view, but there are so many things that he predicts which are actually have come true in the first coming of the Lord. So we understand that they will come true in the second coming as well. And then, of course, it ends with the whole notion of the world coming together to follow Jesus. And we know that certainly happens after the tribulation period, and the Lord has sent his witnesses, and the world is now beginning to worship the King who's back on earth. So it's a pretty interesting outline. Difficult book. Not too many times it's studied or preached on. There are little snippets of it that are preached on, and what I call touch and go sermons, where you touch one verse and then you make generalizations and discussion about it without studying the whole book to see the context. So we've done that. Hopefully, the book of Zechariah will not be a mystery to you any longer, and if you read it again, you'll have some idea of what it's talking about. So we finished in Zechariah 9 last week on the coming of the king. And of course, the king of Zion. Zion is the word for Israel, not the northern kingdom, but the combined houses of Israel, the Judah and Israel. So it's the land of Israel, kind of what we see today. Not as big, but we ended with that, and it's rejoice, O greatly, daughter of Zion, shout aloud, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, your king is coming, righteous and having salvation is he, humble and mounted on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of a donkey. We discussed this on Palm Sunday. We spent a lot of time on why this prophecy was important and what it meant for God to actually come and announce who he was to the state of Israel, and that was the beginning of a time clock, and it was the end of a time clock that had been prophesied way back in Daniel, and we kind of touched on all that. All of this, it begins to set the stage for the coming of Messiah, and you can see here Also, as for you, also because of the blood of my covenant with you, I'll set your prisoners free from the waterless pit. So he's talking about the blood covenant of Christ, and but he hasn't seen the cross. He doesn't know about the cross, but he's talking about the blood covenant. So you know right away that this is a prophecy of God, not a prophecy of man. And he talks about, he's bent Judah as his bow. In other words, Judah will become like a bow, will become powerful. And Ephraim, which is the nation of Jacob, the northern kingdom, will become the bow of, and they will become part of the army and the force of it, and restore you to double. We see Israel today is a thriving land. And then he basically has a little prophecy against Greece about that they will end up battling Greece. And of course that was something that happened, back in the time of Alexander the Great. So we begin to see a little bit of a mixing of prophecies here, new and old. And that's a topic called mountain point prophecies or mountain prophecies. I'll cover that in a class that we do on Tuesday morning, so some of you will get a double dose of that. But the whole idea of that prophecy is you're in your car and you're driving west and you see a mountain in front of you, and that's what you see. But as you get close to it, you begin to see a mountain behind it. But you didn't see that mountain until you got to the first one. And the other thing you don't see is the distance between those mountains. Until you get to the first one, you don't see the second one. And prophecies like that, sometimes there's a prophecy that's close in, but you can't tell if there's a prophecy that's far away. You can't tell how far it is until the first one happens. And then you begin to see it. And that's where we are in a lot of prophetic views right now. We're beginning to see a view of the second mountain or the second end time prophecy. And so Zechariah 9 is in that vein. It brings that, it begins to bring that to bear. We talked about the key points. I won't rehash those today, but he's just talking about restoring Israel and how, the coming of the Lord on the first time is the thing that starts the time when that we look at is the beginning of the church age, because that really starts at Pentecost. But it's he comes, expresses who he is, and then he sets the tone for us to come. And so that's kind of Palm Sunday. Now we get to Zechariah 10, and he's going to now extend that discussion of Israel to restoration. And in this season, it talks about both Israel and Judah. Israel in this time was the northern kingdom. Judah was the southern kingdom. Many times in the Bible, it'll talk about the house of Israel or the house of Jacob. Anytime he does that, he means both northern and southern kingdom. But here he actually sets them apart. One of the other things that I mentioned when we first started this, and you may not remember, but I'll bring it to your mind today. In Zechariah, the prophet is very clear about the Jewish state and the coming world, the coming of the Lord, and what's going to happen then. In the New Testament, the writers of the New Testament put those two together, and they understand the Messiah is part of that continuous kingdom, and we see them put them together when they quote these prophecies. And like you would expect, a prophetic view that expands the Old and the New Testament is really a continuous story. We may look at it as a covenant of the Old Testament, a covenant of the New Testament, but for God, it's a continuing story. It doesn't have a formal break and then we start all over again. They're part of the same story, and that's the way the apostles looked at it when they quoted Zechariah in the New Testament. What we're going to see here is something called Hebrew poetry, and without getting into all the detail, it's not like our poetry. It doesn't have any iambic pentameter, whatever that is, and it doesn't have rhyming words. What it has generally is a couplet of verses, one verse and then a second verse. And what happens there is the second verse either complements the first or it stands in contrast to the verse. And that's the way they do it. You'll see that here as we look at Zechariah 1 through 10. Good morning. Good to have all of you back here. Ask rain from the Lord in the season of the spring rain. from the Lord who makes the storm clouds, and he will give them showers of rain to everyone, the vegetation in the field. So verse one here contains both couplets, right? The first couplet is ask for rain for the Lord in the season of rain. And because the Lord is the one who makes the storm clouds. And then he says, then he will give them showers of rain to everyone, the vegetation in the field. So the second line emphasizes the first and perhaps extends it a little bit. And that's one of the characteristics of Hebrew poetry. Not that you're going to become a Hebrew poet, but you'll also recognize them when you use your, when you open your Bible. Typically, what you'll see is instead of the verses spanning the width of the page, the verses will be short and they'll look like poetry written down or a song lyric written down. And that's because they're either a song or a poetry. And you'll see those in the Bible, even if you don't recognize them as a song or poetry, that's what they are. Psalm is very much that way when you look at the Psalms as well. And then verse two, it says, for the household gods, this is the fake gods, the pagan gods, lowercase g, utter nonsense and the diviners see lies. They tell false dreams and give empty consolation. Therefore, the people wander like sheep. They're afflicted for a lack of a shepherd. Again, this is a general truth that you pray to a god of stone or a god of wood or a god of the sun or a god of the moon or a god of the stars, whatever. If you hear from them, you're not hearing any coherent message from God. And people who say they are diviners, they see lies. They don't, because there's nothing happening. And he says they tell false dreams and give empty consolation. Now we know this is a characteristic of this time in the life of Israel. Very much pagan culture all the way around. You know, the area all around there had multiple gods. They had gods of moon, god of rain, all kinds of gods, and they worshiped these gods. And the actual Muslim god that they call Allah today was one of those gods, the god of the moon, that they picked in 500 AD to consolidate Muslims and get them worshiping one god. But that was only one of 12 that they worshiped. And of course, then they killed everybody who wouldn't worship it. So they got a pretty fast adherence to them, to the Muslim faith. For that reason, and not certainly not voluntary. But isn't that interesting? It says, therefore, people wander like sheep and are afflicted for a lack of a shepherd. I mean, this is a biblical reference because we view the Lord as our shepherd. We'll view him as the good shepherd, and we know that the good shepherd takes care of his sheep. We don't particularly like being viewed as sheep because sheep have some pretty glamorous characteristics. But you know, what it really means is we're people that need direction. We're people that need a shepherd. We're people that need, when we wander off, we need to have the shepherd come get us and drag us back to the fold. And that's kind of a characteristic of human beings. If you haven't noticed, look around. You'll notice we have a lot of wanderers around in the world today. Therefore, yes.
I can remember my dad always having a rabbit's foot. Even to this day, I hear it quite frequently, and it just gives me goosebumps. Knock on wood. It's a terrible thing.
Well, we're all pretty what's the right word? We're all superstitious. We're all superstitious. You know, don't walk under a ladder. You know, don't put an umbrella up outside unless you get baked by the sun. Do what?
Inside. Don't break a mirror.
Inside, whatever. See, I don't even know the saying. Shows you where I am. She keeps me straight on all this stuff. I have a good memory, but not very accurate sometimes. But so I do think you're seeing here that what God is basically saying here, or what Zechariah is saying for God, is that pray to the Lord to do stuff because he's the one that does it. Don't pray to these false gods because even what they say doesn't mean anything. It has no meaning. And people wander because they're lost, because they don't have a shepherd. There's a lot of analogies we could make to the church, to the world we're in right now. You know, Israel always wanted a king because they felt like they were leaderless. They wouldn't accept God as their king, so they wanted a human king, and that didn't work out real well for them until David came along. So all of that is the first two verses, and that really talks about restoration of Israel. And we can just see today, much of this has been fulfilled. Israel today, and you're going to see more verses on this, has come back to the land. In Israel today, they don't worship false gods. They know God is God. They don't maybe not worship God as God because many of them are atheists, or if you wouldn't say atheists, they're certainly agnostic in their view. And we'll talk about why that is, probably. We may talk about that when we do Ezekiel, but I may talk about it before that, beforehand anyway. So Hebrew prophecy, you've seen it now, and you can kind of understand how it works. A couplet, it either reinforces or it stands in contrast to the first verse. I've kind of addressed all this. Zechariah 2, 10-2 addresses a community of Jews who don't have proper leadership, and he's rebuking them for following false gods. And all of these put a contrast together for them to see that they need to trust God as the source of their blessings and to not trust these false gods. So again, this is setting the stage for what's going to happen. And the passage is both a rebuke of what they're doing and an invitation to follow the Lord. He's calling them back to dependence on God rather than on human or in this case, demonic alternatives, gods that don't exist. Today, it's a call for us to find a shepherd. We in this church believe God runs this church. God is our shepherd. We do have under shepherds, and those under shepherds are our pastors. They're the ones that are responsible for the flock, the human flock. God is responsible for the direction. So we understand the relationship between a senior shepherd and a senior pastor. And that it's important for us to always find a church where we follow the Lord, because that's the only faith and truth that we're going to have as we go through all the things going on in the world today. Zechariah 3 through 5, God reacts to the way the people are. And I guess this is important for us for a lot of reasons, but not alone is the fact that God doesn't like people who don't depend on him and people who worship false gods. God says he's a jealous God and he wanted Israel to come back and worship him, and he disciplined them time after time again. And he says here, my anger is hot against the shepherds. Some of your Bibles may say white hot against the shepherds. What it means is a kindled heat. It means that the heat is, it's not just normal burning, but it's been blown. They've got the air bellows and they're blowing the heat and it's getting hotter and hotter. And that's what it means. My anger is hot against the shepherds, not against the sheep, but against the shepherds. Now, who's he talking about here? He's talking about the Jewish leaders, the ones who are supposed to lead the flock, the ones who are supposed to listen to God, take God's message and faithfully pass it on to the people. He says, I will punish the leaders, again, the priests, for the Lord of hosts. The Lord of hosts, I've said a dozen times here, the Lord of hosts is the Lord of angel armies. This is the big guns. This is if I'm unhappy and I call out the angel armies as God, something majestic is going to happen very quickly. And he says, the Lord of hosts, the God of angel armies, cares for his flock, the house of Judah, and will make him like his majestic steed in battle. In other words, he will make them powerful. He'll make them strong. What do we see in Israel today? We see a strong land. I mean, people look at Israel and think, what a mighty army they have. And they do. But let me tell you something, they're a mighty army because God is there. They're not mighty compared to the number of Muslims in the world. They're not mighty compared to the number of Russian armies, or the amount of missiles that Syria had, or not Syria, but Iran. But they're mighty because God is with them, and that's they're beginning to see that now, which I think is a pretty interesting prophecy as well. From him shall come the cornerstone. from him being the house of Judah, the land of Israel, the cornerstone. Now we know who the cornerstone is, don't we? Because we see the cornerstone come later. That's the Messiah. And that's the stone on which the foundation of the future is built. And from him, the tent peg. What's the tent peg? It's kind of an interesting analogy, but what's a tent peg do? It holds the tent down, holds it tight. It's a stabilizing factor. So he's saying not only is this Messiah going to be the cornerstone, but from him will come those that hold the tent, those that keep all of it going for the Lord. From him, the battle bow. So from all of that becomes a mighty army, people that hold Israel together, people that build on the cornerstone. And it says, all of them together. They shall be mighty men in battle, trampling the foe in the mud of the streets. They'll fight because the Lord is with them. They shall put to shame the riders on horses. Remember, these prophets saw things in terms of what they understood. So what does a rider on horses mean? Well, I kind of talk through this as we go through it. But so God expressed his anger against the leaders. He's expressing his divine anger, but he's also expressing his desire for them to flourish. In some translations, the word shepherd in your translation of your Bible may not say shepherd, it may say goat or goat herd, which is kind of funny because God is basically using a derisive term. The editors here use shepherds, which is not derisive, but the derisive term that's actually used in the Hebrew and the Greek is goat herd. Now, what does that mean? It means the leader of the goats, not the leader of the sheep. So he's calling the leaders of Israel goat leaders, because goats are always viewed as not the followers. We separate the sheep from the goats. A little bit of God's humor, I believe, in what we see here. The editors sometimes don't like to leave that lingering, so they switch it to shepherd. But I think it's important to see it in the way it was actually written. When I go back to this verse, it says, "My anger is hot against the goat herders." Is a better way to look at that, because that's the way God feels about them. And then it comes back and it shifts to the punishment of the leaders, and it describes, and again in poetry form, how the armies are going to become flourishing and all that. And it also reflects two things. It reflects a short-term prophecy, which we do see, where Israel has come back into the land. Israel is strong, but it also reflects a longer term prophecy where Israel is going to be protected by the Lord because the Lord cares for his flock and the Lord is with his flock, and the people perceive that the Lord is with them. That's just now coming into play. You see, if you read the stories in Israel today, there are many Jews who are now doing two things. One is they're beginning to warm up to Christians who they've not liked for a long time because they view us as the people that instigated the Romans, and they view the Romans as the Christians. All of that is rooted in history, but it's also rooted in bad theology. But that's the way they think about it today. But they're finally beginning to understand that they have no better friends in the world than the evangelical Christians who love them and love Israel. They're beginning to sense also that they're just not so good that they can whip all these other people. That something is with them. The fact that these missiles knock down 95%, these defenses knock down 95% or 98% of the missiles is not just luck. It's because God is in the mix, either in the design and the implementation. And they're beginning to see that. So you're beginning to see a change in Israel, which I think is real positive and also very prophetic, as they come to a point where they're going to have to make a decision about the Lord. And about what their current beliefs are. Now we know that time is the tribulation period, which tells me that we're getting closer and closer to that because the scene is getting set over there. So all of that is kind of both a short-term and a long-term prophetic view. Then he comes on and he talks about Judah and Joseph. Joseph again references the northern kingdom. So I will strengthen the house of Judah, and I'll save the house of Joseph, Judah and Joda, Judah and Joseph. Huff. What he means by that is the house of Judah was where, that's the house where the house of Benjamin and the house of Judah, that's where Israel was. That's where the most loyal of the tribes were to the Lord. The house of Joseph, the northern kingdom, was the house that abandoned God, abandoned him to the false gods. He carried them off into Assyria, and many people call them the 10 lost tribes of Israel. Well, they may be lost to history, but they're not lost to God. And God said, I will save the house of Joseph. God knows who they are. We may not know. The records may have been burned. They may not have strong DNA and strong ancestry that they can go to, but God knows who they are, and God is beginning to restore them. I'll bring them back because they did well. No, I'll bring them back because I have compassion on them. You know, God deals with us out of mercy and compassion. If he dealt with us out of justice, we really wouldn't like what happens to us. And they shall be as though I had not rejected them. Remember, God rejected that northern kingdom and the Assyrians hauled them off. God rejected the southern kingdom and the Babylonians hauled them off. But the Babylonians didn't kill them all, and they allowed some to come back. The Assyrians wiped as many of them out as they could, and they also intermarried with all the people up there, so there was no distinct bloodlines of the Jews left. And so God rejected them, and he punished them. And then it says, then Ephraim shall become like a mighty warrior, and their hearts will be glad as with wine. I don't know how this works, but I think people that drink a little wine sometimes get a little happy. Is that what that means? Getting up on the table, maybe? I don't know. Ephraim shall become mighty warrior, and their hearts shall be glad as with wine. I mean, that's a powerful statement. Remember, their understanding of, you know, wine and all of the things like that was based on who they were and the fact that their water was terrible and they drink a lot of wine, some of it strong, some of it not strong. So don't get too excited about that. It says their children shall see it and be glad. Their hearts shall rejoice in the Lord. Do you think the children of Israel today are glad to see them restored to power? I don't think you can look at the record of what's called Aliyah, where people going back to Judah and going back to Israel, and not understand that people are moving back there because they're going home and they want their children to be raised in the land of the Jews. They want their children to be raised in a land of belief. And maybe they haven't been good believers, but they go back for that and get back in the land. And that's powerful, but it's also prophetic, and we're seeing it today in very strong ways. And I think their children are glad. I don't think if you move back with your family and your children are raised in Israel, most of them do not leave Israel. They stay. They may go abroad for work, but they'll come back, and that's always their home. And I think that's kind of God pulling them back to where they need to be. Then in verse 8 through 10, this is a prophecy being fulfilled. And you look at this and you think, what in the world does that mean? I will whistle for them and gather them in, for I have redeemed them, and they shall be as many as they were before. Well, this is a shepherd's whistle. When a shepherd had a flock and they were in the field, they whistled for them. Whether it was a mechanical whistle or they whistled with their fingers, that's the sound that the sheep heard, and they knew it was time to head back to the barn or come back home. And you know, people do that today for animals that are away. They sound a horn, or they blow a trumpet, or they do something. They ring a bell, and the animal hears it, and they come home. And so that's what this prophecy is. God is saying, they're my sheep, and they're all over the world, but I will whistle for them. And they may not hear a real whistle, but in their heart, they will hear the whistle of the Lord calling them to come home. For I have redeemed them. I have begun to pull them back, buy them back out of their slavery, and bring them home. And they shall be as many as there were before. Israel's not a big country today. It's got like 10 million people in it, and about 2 million of them are non-Jews. About 8 million of them are Jews. The next biggest country in the world for Jews is America, and we have about 8 million Jews in America. So we, not quite as many. We have almost as many Jews in America as they have in Israel. But what you see is a steady increase, and maybe it's 100,000 a year, and it's not a lot, but it doesn't take too many years for that 8 million to be whittled down. We're seeing them move back to Israel. And my guess is, with anti-Semitism going on in the world, you're going to see that more often. Younger people are going to move back before they get entrenched and get in jobs. They're going to move back there. And I think that's what's going to happen. It says, though I scattered them among the nations, yet in far countries they shall remember me, and their children shall live in return. This is an important point. If you think about the Moabites, and you think about the Edomites, and you think about the, what is it Joel Rosenberg says, the Hittites and the termites, you think about all the ites over there, and you think about that when they were taken over and they moved away, their lines disappeared. They are no more. There's no Edomites left. There may be descendants of Edomites. The Palestinians are kind of part of the descendants of the Edomites, but they're not a distinct nation. But the Jews didn't do that. When they were in Russia or when they were in Poland, they kept together. They invented the term ghetto for where the Jews lived together, and they maintained as best they could their culture. And so when God called them home, they were ready to restore their culture back in their own land. And so this is a prophecy that has come true. We live in 2026, and we don't see that happen, but that happened, in the 40s and 50s in big point when Israel became a land. It says, I'll bring them home from Egypt and gather them from all Assyria. I'll bring them to the land of Gilead and to Lebanon till there is no more room for them. Again, we're looking at Zechariah, who had a 500 BC view of what the land looked like, but he's bringing them home, bringing them from Egypt, which was a big enemy, bringing them from Assyria, which was a big enemy. And he's not thinking Russia and Poland and America. He's not thinking that because that hasn't come to pass yet. But he's bringing them home until there's no room for them. And a curious thing, if you don't pay attention to it, there's a big battle in Israel right now for what's called settlements. And you know what a settlement is? A settlement is, Israel right now is divided into multiple parts. There's the land that Israel acknowledges as their land, the world acknowledges as their land, and they have control over. There's land that Israel says is theirs, and it's part of their land, but the world says it's the West Bank, and not Samaria and Judea. So we view it as Samaria and Judea. But what's happening is so many Jews are returning, they don't have space for them. So they're beginning to build settlements in these Arab territories, and there's a big fight going on because the Arabs don't want the Jews in their territory. The Jews have no place to go, so they're beginning to build out there, and that's going to be another battleground. You're seeing it right now in the skirmishes between the settlers and the native Arabs there, till there's no room for them. I mean, this is 500 BC, and we're seeing Zechariah, who has a he doesn't have any idea what he's talking about, but he knows what God told him to write, and that's what he writes, and that's what's come true. And I think it's really a sobering reality for us is if we pay attention, we're seeing all these little fingers of God coming home and all these little tasks beginning to fulfill. And it's a comforting thing to know that this is not some invention of somebody in 19 or in 2025 or 2026. This is a 2,500 year old prophecy that we're beginning to see come to pass right now. But most people who don't read their Bible wouldn't have any idea about that. But if you read it and you understand it, you know that we're seeing this play out right in front of us, and it's exciting. And then Zechariah 10, 11, and 12 says, even in a time of trouble, he shall pass through the sea of troubles and strike down the waves of the sea, and all the depths of the Nile shall be dried up. The pride of Assyria shall be laid low, and the scepter of Egypt shall depart. This is pretty mystical when you look at it, but I would just say, step back and look at the deeper meaning of what he's saying here. He's basically saying, this land will not be without trouble. This land will be in trouble, even when it comes back. It'll not be without trouble, but the land will strike down all the waves. You know, if you're in the sea and it's rough seas and there's big waves coming, you not only fight the sea, but you're fighting every wave that hits you. Israel's that way today. I mean, they got battles on six fronts and rockets coming from every different direction. And they've had that pretty much since 1948. And so God is there. They're going to pass through the sea of trouble. They're going to strike down all those waves that would cover them over. All the depths of the Nile shall be dried up. In other words, all of the paths, all of the troubles, all of the resources of the enemy will be dried up. The pride of Assyria was their ability to dominate everybody in their area because they were so bloodthirsty. Well, Assyria's got its own problems today. They're killing each other. They're killing everybody in there. They're leaving Israel alone right now. You know, now Lebanon's not, but Syria is. And it's kind of interesting. The pride of Assyria should be laid low. They're low right now. They're fighting for their own survival. And the scepter of Egypt. Remember, when you go back in the old days and you look at the pharaohs, who was the big dog over there? The big dog was Egypt. They had pharaohs, they had armies, they had, you know, seashores, they controlled massive areas. The scepter is a symbol of kingly power. So the scepter of Egypt shall depart. In other words, God's allowing them to be controllers and big participants is going to depart from them. And you see today, Egypt is just one of the many players over there. Certainly important historically, but they've stayed out of the fray for the most part, which is been beneficial for Israel. I will make them strong in the Lord, and they shall walk in his name. I think this is a prophecy that we're seeing. I don't think it's a prophecy that's been fulfilled yet, at least in its fullest form. But
have we become less and less supportive of the Jews in the United States? Don't you think our power is going to shrink things as well?
I would just say that those who support Israel and bless Israel, God blesses. Those who don't, he punishes. So I do think that we will, what will happen is the strength given to us by God will begin to dissipate and we will become just another one of the nations in the world. I personally think that's going to happen at the time of the rapture. Because I think if you take America and you take, pick the number, I don't know, 30 million Christians, and we're gone, what's going to happen? Certainly Congress is not going to be much affected. But I do think the heartland, I do think the armies, I do think the soldiers who are in the field, I think those guys, and I think the heartland of Christians and the people that do the work every day in this land, there's going to be a vacuum that we will not be able to, we won't have factories that work anymore. We don't have manufacturing base. We won't be able to field an army. I don't know how it's going to work, but that's a big instant to me, first world to third world change that will happen. It may happen slowly before then, but certainly if the rapture comes sooner rather than later, I think that will be an instant result. Me personally, I don't, that's not, you know, a prophetic book of the Bible. That's just me talking, but that's what I think will happen. And I think what we're seeing here is the fact that the Jews are beginning to be comfortable with God as their protector. I don't think they're real comfortable yet. They're certainly not going out on too many limbs, you know, but they're amazing in what they can pull off. And amazing in the way they can execute things. There's nobody in the world that has a better intelligence service than the Mossad. I mean, you look at them and you think, how in the world did they pull that off? But they do. And I think that's just part of the whole story. It's interesting that people all over Europe now are beginning to buy armaments from Israel. The other thing, to your point, Israel declared about 6 or 7 months ago, I mentioned it then, but I'll mention it again now, they are going to become self-supporting. They're going to start building all their own armaments. They don't want to be buying bombs from the U.S. because if the U.S. cuts them off, they have no way to defend themselves. So they're going to build factories and build their own. And I'm perfectly fine with that, because just like we need to buy and build factories to build our own medical supplies, if we have to buy drugs from China and they decide to cut us off, what are we going to do if all of our drugs go away? There's a whole lot of that sorting out going on in the world right now, and I think God is orchestrating that, or he's letting it happen, however you want to look at that. So Zechariah 11 through chapter 1 through 3, this is what I call a taunting song. You know how, if you're a football player or football watcher, somebody's defense has been really strong, and then all of a sudden the offense makes a touchdown. They score some miraculous point. The guy who scores the touchdown gets up, does his dance in the end zone, spins the ball, and that's fine. But if they say something to the opposing team, what happens? They give a penalty for taunting. Well, listen to this. So, open your doors, O Lebanon, that fire may devour your cedars. Wail, O Cyprus, for the cedar has fallen, for the glorious trees are ruined. Wail, oaks of Bashan, for the thick forest has been felled. The sound of the wail of the shepherds, for their glory is ruined. The sound of the roar of the lions, for the thicket of the Jordan is ruined. So let me kind of translate that for you. What he's basically saying is all those foreign rulers who have depended on their forests of cedar, that's how they make their money, or their forests of oak, all of that is being done away with. They're being burnt to the ground. And all of that is done to enable God's people to return to the land. And he uses metaphors here to really say, remember Clint Eastwood? No, most of you remember Clint Eastwood. If somebody would say something to him, what would he say? Make my day. Well, this is a make my day quote to them. He's basically saying, okay, open your doors, let the fires in. Open your doors. The trees are coming down. You're going to be without power. You're going to be a kingdom. You're going to be a king with no resources because I'm building back the land, and you're going to be wailing and crying about it, but your glory is gone. Your power is gone. And the lions that used to roar when they would come after Israel are not going to roar any longer because they can't hide in the thicket. Their food is now powerful and strong, and they can't react. So this is all kind of it is metaphor. It is poetry. But if you understand and think about what he's saying, you can get what's underneath it. If you try to look at it and say, well, what doors are they opening? If you try to look too far into the symbols, you miss the point of what this is about. And the sound of the wail of the shepherds, again, this is the leaders, the people that are crying because their sheep are gone, their forests are gone, their powers are gone. So all of this is kind of interesting, and it shifts from foreign rulers to describing them as lions and all this kind of stuff. So there's a two-part taunt to this, and you can see the pattern also of the poetry here in this set of verses. Then he goes on to say, "Thus said the Lord my God," and I will be finished before too long. "Thus said the Lord my God, become shepherd of the flock doomed to slaughter." This is interesting. And he's talking about the rulers again of Israel. They have become shepherds to a flock that's not going to survive. Again, if you look at this as goat herds, you're going to see he's basically saying, become the goat herd of the goat flock because they are doomed to slaughter. Those who buy them to slaughter them go unpunished, and those who sell them say, blessed be the Lord, I've become rich, and their own shepherds have no pity on them. He's talking about the leaders of Israel who basically do everything they can to make money off the sheep, off the people of the country. Nobody punishes them, and yet they're bold to say, look how rich I am, look how wonderful I am, because I have made money, and I don't have any pity for the people that are poor, the people that can't afford the food. I'm taking what they have, and I'm going to keep it to myself. And then he says, "For I will no longer have pity on the inhabitants of this land," declares the Lord. Again, he's talking about the Jews in this time. "Behold, I will cause each of them to fall into the hands of his neighbor, and each into the hand of his king, and they shall crush the land, and I will deliver none from their hands." He's basically now come back to the notion that those who don't follow him, those that the shepherds lead, are going to be crushed in the land, and he's going to do the crushing, and he's not going to come back and save any of them from this. And then we finished what I wanted to do here just by summarizing this by saying, because their leaders exploited the flock for personal gain, God is going to punish them. And this is a pretty direct application for us today. I think if we look at the church today, and if we look at TV preachers, and we look at people online, and we some churches we go to, it's all about money making. It's all about, selling my book. It's all about this. It's all about that. And many of that, they're less interested in the welfare of the flock than they are with the flock as a people with money who can support a lifestyle. And that's a terrible thing. And as the Bible tells us, those who are leaders will be judged severely if they don't lead the way God has called them. If they're goat herds instead of shepherds, that's going to be a big problem. And I think sooner or later, God's patience is exhausted. He will try to redeem us, but sooner or later it's exhausted. And we see this was fulfilled by the Babylonians when they captured Jerusalem in 586 BC. So you see a lot of these prophecies were completed, and he's talked about them in here. And I'm going to stop here because I don't want to get too far into the next part, and I'm also out of time. So any questions or any thoughts? I know this is kind of a whole set of prophetic things that are a little bit maybe higher than is easy to understand. It's not as direct as we might like. But if you step back away from the symbols and kind of look at what he's saying, much like in Revelation, if you forget the bowls and the trumpets and the vials and the seals, if you forget those and just think about the progressive judgment of God, you get a much better picture of what he's trying to do than focusing on all the symbols, which are not really, they're just a tool to show you kind of how he's doing it and how they're related.
I think these are such awesome messages that we, through the power of the Holy Spirit, deliver to our grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and as we mentor young people, that they can really do anything they want within the will of the Lord for their life if they call on him.
Right. And all of this, again, some of these passages are quoted in the New Testament, and those are certainly quotable passages. But the whole tone of the book is really about what Zechariah is telling the land to do, the people to do, and then how he takes that and moves it into a near-term prophecy and a longer-term prophecy. And that's where it really affects us today. So your point is well taken. So let's do this. We'll pick up where we left off next week, but I would just ask you this week to pray for what you normally pray for. Certainly peace, the peace of Jerusalem, the peace that will give us some lasting peace in the Middle East. Pray for our own nation, pray for our leaders, pray for our state, our leaders here. Certainly we need that. Pray for our church, pray for the pastors. I got an inside view this week about Pastor Mike and the work he does in this church. And let me just tell you, he works 7 days a week. He's never off. He doesn't begrudge it. He loves it because he's doing what God has called him to do. But these people need our prayers. They struggle with workload every single week. We had two funerals the same day at Ingram Funeral Home, another person in this church. Mike couldn't do that funeral because he was doing the first one, but they were back to back, and it just kind of tells you what the season we're in right now.
And I think we pray for Mike's wife
Oh yeah,
as
absolutely.
well, with she's so giving
I'm sure she packs his lunch and puts him in the car and sends him on his
of.
way. So just pray for that. But also all the things we've lifted here, all of our the needs we have in this class, and then the mercy for everything we do and what we need to struggle with every day as well. So I appreciate all of you, and let me close in prayer before I'm preaching to myself here. Lord, thank you for this time of study. Thank you for those that come and share your word. Lord, I pray that your word has opened your mind and your heart to us, and we see that you always give us a way. You always show us the light. You always show us a way to get away from your judgment and to come to your blessing. Lord, help us be reactive. Help us be responsive. Help us follow the lead you've given us. Lord, I pray this for all of us. I pray it for our country and our church. Lord, I pray for the pastor as he comes this morning. I pray the message you've given him is the anointed word that is supposed to come to us today for our time of need. I pray that it reaches each one into our very heart, and the point of need we have, we see in the sermon. I pray for everybody here. I pray is for this week of all the prayer requests. And I pray it all in the blessed and holy name of Jesus Christ. Amen. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jim.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks, you guys.